I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the last 8 months, New Hampshire Public Radio has been exploring our state's immigration story. And if that story had a backbone, it would be the Merrimack River. As it approached Manchester, the mighty Merrimack dropped in such a way that made the city ripe for manufacturing. In fact, at one time, the Queen City was considered the textile capital of the world. As industry grew, so did the need for more workers, and that's where immigrants came in, from Canada, Ireland, Greece, Eastern Europe, and elsewhere. The same story also played out on the Androscoggin River, the Piscataqua, and the Connecticut, and in fact across the nation, as immigrants helped build railroads, fueled the automotive industry, worked in restaurants, hotels, and especially labored in our fields. Our guest today, Mark Krikorian, agrees that immigrants played a vital role in the industrial growth of our country, but he believes that in 2012, that time has passed. Krikorian is executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies and the grandson of immigrants himself. He says America today is far different than the country to which our grandparents arrived, and that the mass immigration, which once fueled our country's economy, now serves as its detriment. Today in The Exchange, as part of our year-long project on immigration, we begin a three-day series looking at immigration and the economy. We begin with Mark Krikorian and why he says immigration is now holding our economy back. Let's hear from you. What role do you think immigration plays in our economy today? Do you agree with Krikorian that the net benefits of immigration have run their course, or do you see examples where it still helps? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email at exchange@nhpr.org or post your comments on our Facebook page. And Mark Krikorian joins us from his office in D.C. And Mark, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, you've often said, Mark, when making this case, that it's not about the immigrants themselves. It's about us. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that the immigrants today really aren't that different from those who came 100 or 150 years ago. You know, they're coming from the same kinds of places. They're very similar people in a lot of ways, different countries for the most part, but they're really not that different. What's different is the country they're coming to. We are a post-industrial, knowledge-based economy. We have a large government sector now, welfare state, but not just that. You know, schools, education, all of that funded by taxpayers. The world has shrunk in a lot of ways with communications and transportation technology, making the situation very different. You left Ireland 150 years ago, and, you know, you probably never went back. You certainly didn't pick up the phone and call the old country. The point is that all of those things together mean that the situation that immigrants are coming into now is radically different. It's different in kind from anything that we've had in the past.
And you've often been accused, Mark, of being anti-immigrant. Some have even called you, you know, racist. And you've said, no, you know, I'm the grandson of immigrants. Talk about that a little bit, Mark, that this, you say, is not personal animus against anybody. It's an economic argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's a variety of arguments. Economics is sort of at the center of it, but it really doesn't have anything to do with who the immigrants are. It didn't in the past, and it doesn't now. The fact is that, a lot of the people listening to this program are themselves the children or grandchildren or even further of immigrants from Quebec or from Ireland or from somewhere else. But the question is not, I mean, when we're thinking about policy and what kind of policy we're going to have for future immigration, because that's what we're talking about, tomorrow's immigration policy, what should it be? We shouldn't be looking at that based on what worked for our grandparents, but rather what's in the best interest of our grandchildren. And it's irresponsible to look back when making policy rather than to look at the needs of our children and grandchildren who are coming after us.
Well, and we'll definitely go piece by piece throughout the hour, Mark, on those economic arguments. But just to draw this timeline, so you said, again, you know, immigrants definitely played a huge role in the industrial growth of our country, from the railroads to the farms to the textile mills here in New England. When do you see that economic benefit shifting to an economic drain?
Well, I don't know that there's sort of a particular year or month or day you can pick when the switch flicked, but clearly immigration was almost cut off in the 20s, 1921 and 24. And then we had about 50 years of very low levels of immigration, and then it started up again, partly due to the 1965 immigration law, which nobody intended to restart immigration, but it did anyway, accidentally almost. Somewhere in that period, you know, in that 50-year period where, you know, America's middle class expanded, I mean, from the 20s to the 70s, that was sort of one of the most, I mean, the United States kind of developed into a world power at that point. Somewhere in there is when really our economy and our society changed so significantly that high levels of immigration, that we basically outgrew high levels of immigration.
Well, let's look at the economics then, Mark, and hit number one right on the head that always comes up when you look at this question. The number one argument that people often make for immigration in an economic light is that immigrants fill a vital role because they're willing to do the jobs Americans won't do. You know, we hear stories about farmers trying to hire American citizens. After a couple of days, those workers are gone. They don't want to do the back-breaking work that immigrants are willing to do. I wonder what you think about that.
The fact is that there's no work that isn't going to get done without immigrants. And I'm not saying that in cases like when you're talking to a particular farmer, a guy who's growing raisin grapes in Fresno or apples in New Hampshire, that he's lying to you. No, he's not. He's just can't see the forest for the trees. I mean, he's operating kind of in the moment. And yes, probably tomorrow, if all his immigrants disappeared, immigrant workers disappeared, and everything were the same, the wages he paid, the benefits he offered, all of that were the same, he might well have trouble, recruiting and retaining American or legal immigrant workers. But that's not the way, you know, policymakers need to think of it. The question is, can the economy, those sectors of the economy that use a lot of immigrant labor, can they adjust if the source, the supply of immigrant workers shrinks because of policy? And the answer is, of course they can. The reason I know that is that Adam Smith told me so. Supply and demand works in the labor market just like it works anywhere else. And we've seen it happen a number of times. Just as a quick example, there was a series of big raids on meatpacking plants around the country. This was now in 06, I think. And we sent an investigative reporter to each of those towns, talked to people, figured out what the consequences were. And the fact is, all those meatpacking plants were back up and running after the illegal workers either were arrested or ran off. And what the managers had to do was raise the wages and benefits somewhat and come up with ways like a van pool, a free van ride, you know, from a nearby town to get workers, that kind of thing. You know, businesses, employers do it and they adjust. And the fact is that low-skilled workers end up being better off because their labor is more valuable, more valued to employers, so the employers have to find ways of getting those people to want to work for them.
Well, I know you're involved in a lot of policy circles and policy discussions there in D.C., Mark. So what does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce say to you when you make that argument? Look, guys, you know, you're going to have to raise wages and workplace benefits.
Yeah, well, I mean, specifically, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is actually pretty terrible on the immigration issue. They're
in your opinion.
Well, yeah, exactly. From my perspective, they're terrible. I mean, their goal is essentially unregulated immigration because there are certain industries, many industries really don't really, you know, depend on immigrant labor that much, but there are specific industries, you know, certain kinds of agriculture, certain parts of the construction or service industries that use a lot of immigrant labor, and they basically want the labor as cheap and as controllable as possible. This is kind of a story of American history going back for hundreds of years. It's just part of human nature. The question for policymakers is, you know, the question is how much ability should employers have to make an end run around the American labor market? In other words, should we force employers to actually make do with the workers we have here, one way or another, or should we let them basically just bring in anybody they want and use anybody they want? And the fact is that that is not in the interest of low-skilled American workers. It's not in the interest of taxpayers. It's just not in the national interest in general, although if you're a particular hotel owner, say, or some sort of landscaping company, clearly it's in your narrow short-term interest. You win from loose borders and high levels of immigration, but the country overall loses.
Yeah, well, so what do they say to you? Because this is an argument we hear again and again from businesses that, you know, they need these workers and that their, you know, their lettuce will be unpicked and their hotel rooms will be uncleaned if they don't have, you know, low-skilled, low-paid immigrant labor.
Yeah, well, I mean, is a really good example of this. From the 40s to the 60s, we had this big guest worker program where Mexican farm workers were brought in legally. It was called the Bracero program. Mostly they worked in Midwestern farms. And Congress debated getting rid of that in the 60s. It was seen as a kind of civil rights measure to get rid of it because the program was very exploitative. Really, it was bad news. And the tomato farmers, the guys who grew tomatoes for processing, for ketchup and sauce and stuff, because almost all produce ends up being processed. It's not fresh in the produce market section of your supermarket. Anyway, they said, if Congress ends this program, you know, not another tomato will be grown in California. You know, the usual lobbyist kind of baloney. Well, Congress got rid of it anyway, and the farmers said, well, okay, you know, we gave it a try, so now we're going to have to go to Plan B, which is invest money in harvesting machines. And the result was not illegal immigration right away. That took years to kind of catch up. What they did in the meantime was invest in harvest machinery. The production of processing tomatoes increased. The real retail price, post-inflation retail price of tomato products, fell precisely because the farmers were denied that outside source of labor and made their industry more capital-intensive, more technologically advanced.
So for the processed stuff, where it doesn't matter if it gets a little banged up, you can mechanize that. What about the stuff that looks so pretty on the shelf in the supermarket? I'm guessing that has to be handpicked.
Well, it's harder to mechanize. But even there's a lot of work on mechanization. I mean, when Congress ended this guest worker program, there was a good 15-plus years before illegal immigration really became big enough to make a difference. It took 15 years of not enforcing the law for it to kind of make up much of the slack. During that 15 years, there was a huge amount of mechanization in all kinds of areas, both processing and fresh fruit. When illegal immigration got big enough, the mechanization slowed to a halt.
All right, and after a short break, we'll dig into a couple more of the economic questions that often come up surrounding immigration. We'll start taking your calls, too, so join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members. Support also comes to us from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, launching the new MBA in Strategic Leadership. Information at nec.edu. And from Holloway Motor Cars of Manchester, authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer, featuring the 2012 E-Class, combining a signature blend of performance, luxury, and technology. BenzCars.com. More of our immigration series on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, insights into the causes of autism. New Hampshire weather for today, partly to mostly cloudy statewide with a chance of a few showers. Highs near 50 in the North Country, 50 to 55 in central parts of the state, 55 to 60 in southern New Hampshire. For tonight, cloudy, a chance of a shower. Lows near 32 from the White Mountains north, mid to upper 30s for the rest of the state. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, some scattered showers. Highs from 47 north, ranging to 55 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, as part of our immigration series, we're taking a look at the economics of this issue. Over the next few days, we'll offer several perspectives. Today, we're talking with Mark Krikorian, who makes the case that large-scale immigration hurts our economy. Let's hear from you. When you look at the economics of immigration, what do you think? What role do you see immigration playing in our economy? Is it a positive role or a negative role? Has our country, as Krikorian says, outgrown the need for mass immigration? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. Mark Krikorian is Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, author of the book The New Case Against Immigration, as well as several other books and numerous articles. One more time, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And so, Mark, just before the break, we were getting into the specifics of tomatoes and, you know, whether if all of a sudden immigrants left left en masse. Tomatoes would remain unpicked. I'd end up paying more for tomatoes at the grocery store. You could put this analogy to lettuce and just about anything. What do you think? If there's no mass immigration as we have now, do I end up paying a lot more for my food?
No. The fact is it just doesn't work that way. And the reason is that low-skilled workers, whether they're immigrants or native-born, in a modern economy like ours, just don't contribute that much to GNP. I mean, they're basically, you know, pay is based on productivity. You're paid less because your work isn't that productive. And just to give specifically an example about fruits and vegetables, because this is the most immigrant-dependent sector of the economy, harvesting fruits and vegetables. And everybody sort of thinks, you know, look, if immigration wasn't here, boy, I'd have to pay $7 for a tomato, that kind of thing. Well, agricultural economist, who's sort of the authority on these matters out in California, he actually looked at the numbers. And his estimate was that if farm workers all got a 40% raise overnight, 40%, which is what the United Farm Workers was pushing for, the average American household annual cost for produce, for vegetables and fruits, would go up by something like $30 or so.
Over the year.
For a whole year. Because, and the reason here, people don't get that. The reason is that the farm worker gets only a tiny share of the retail price of that head of lettuce. I mean, if a head of lettuce just, you know, sort of pick a round number, costs a dollar, the, you know, the increasing the wage of the farm worker by 40% would increase that by a couple of cents, 2, 3, 4, 5 cents maybe, something like that. You wouldn't even notice. You wouldn't be able to tell unless you were some kind of accountant and tracked this stuff very closely. So the answer is no. There is no real prospect of, you know, inflationary effect from less immigration. And remember, we're not talking about all immigrants, you know, tomorrow we wake up and they're all gone. You're talking about a gradual shrinking in the share of immigrants in the labor force, something that takes time and therefore the economy easily adjusts to.
Well, that's hard to get your head around, though. I mean, just economics 101, you know, it says cost of benefits and wages for workers go up, consumer costs go up. So it seems like it should be a direct connection there.
I mean, I'm not saying they won't go up. I'm saying that the wages that are paid to lower skilled workers, because that's not what we're talking about, don't account for very much of the actual price that you pay in the store. So yes, the price of your head of lettuce or a hotel room or something might well go up a little bit. My point is, it's going to be very, very small and likely would be offset by lower government costs, social costs, since low-skilled people, immigrants or natives, make such heavy use of taxpayer-funded government services. I mean, the National Academy of Sciences looked at this issue. The numbers are now like 15 years old, so they're not current, but the concept is right. And their estimate was that immigrants clearly create some kind of small economic benefit when you add it on. In other words, through lower prices, through driving down wages, they create a small economic benefit for the whole country put together. But that is totally wiped out, and then some, by the extra social costs that importing low-skilled people create. So the point is that having fewer of them would in fact create in very small amount of higher prices, which would be completely offset and then some by less government services.
Well, and that social cost issue is a matter of great debate, and I want to get into that with you, Mark, but let's take some calls too. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call. What role do you see immigration playing in our economy here in New Hampshire and nationally? How do you feel about Mark Krikorian's argument that America has outgrown the need for mass immigration? Yes, immigrants help build this country, help make it an economic powerhouse, but today he says mass immigration no longer fits our high-tech, modernized economy. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Mark Bryan's up from Nashua first. Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks much. Great show today. Really great topic to discuss. I just want to take issue with Mr. Kerkorian on the idea that we don't need immigration, that mass immigration anymore. We have, historically, it has been very beneficial to our country, and I will tell you that I am absolutely opposed to illegal immigration and the costs that are incurred in this country regarding it. But what about the issue of the fact that we have aging demographics in this country? Most of the world, most of the industrialized world, has aging demographics. We're not affected as negatively as Europe and Russia and China are. But yet, nonetheless, in the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to have an aging population. We have less people coming up through the system to take over, to pay those health care costs that the aging population is going to need. And one of the things, I'm third generation Irish American, okay? And when my grandparents came over on the boat, they didn't have a great education. They had to start at the bottom. They were filling those jobs, those low paying jobs that Americans need. And gradually through that, they were able to send their children to college, and my parents sent me to college. Now we're productive members of a technological society.
Okay.
I mean, what are we going to do? How are we going to support those aging demographics in the future?
Yeah, and Brian, this is a big point that comes up a lot nationally, and especially, Mark, here in New Hampshire, we have the distinction of being one of the grayer states in the nation. So the argument is often made, what Brian makes, you know, we need immigrants as our population ages to keep our demographics young and vibrant.
Well, I mean, first, Brian, I'm glad he acknowledged that this is not, we are not in the kind of pickle that Europe or East Asia are. The fact is, our birth rate is, you know, even among the native born, is right about at replacement. In other words, the average woman having about two kids in her lifetime, which is, you know, eventually would lead to a stable population. We're not in the situation of Japan or Italy or even China or Tunisia. I mean, the birth rates are falling everywhere in the world. Mexico's birth rate is only just a couple of ticks above ours and is almost certainly going to fall below ours in the next 10 years or so. So this is a problem everybody has to face. The idea of using immigration to try to forestall the aging of the population doesn't work for a couple reasons. First of all, our population is very, very large. We have 300 plus million people. Immigration would have to be at enormous levels. I mean, five times what it is now to make really much of a dent in that. Secondly, immigrants get older themselves. You know, they start aging, and then you have to have even more new immigrants to keep the population younger. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not sustainable. And, you know, we actually, I mean, I have a, one of my researchers is kind of looking at projecting ahead and looking at the numbers, and the fact is that increasing the retirement age by a couple of years completely swamps, is much larger an effect in, you know, in preserving the size of the labor force than very high levels of immigration. We need to look at other ways of coping with this natural process of an aging, you know, a higher average age in our population. Immigration is not going to fix stuff. And, you know, his point about, you know, who's going to pay for health care in the future, you know, importing high school dropout landscapers from Central America is not going to result in people who are going to be paying a lot of taxes in the future to support old people. And about the idea of upward mobility, it's no question. Today, you know, the children of immigrants, just like in the past, do better than their parents. Statistically, that's true. In fact, the jump ahead, the percentage increase that the kids of immigrants make over the immigrants themselves seems to be roughly similar to what it was in the past. The problem is that today's immigrants are starting so much farther behind the average population, the income, that even though their kids do better, their kids still don't catch up on average. Whereas 100 years ago, when my grandparents or other people came here, immigrants' skills and education weren't that different from those of Americans. And so the kids did better, and upward mobility was possible in the kind of economy that didn't demand high levels of education. We don't live in that economy anymore. That world is gone, and it's gone forever.
Well, and we've certainly done shows on what some say is stickier upward mobility for everybody these days. Quickly, Mark, on that point, immigrants get older themselves. Doesn't the research show, though, that they do tend to have larger families? So you are injecting a younger demographic into society.
They do have somewhat larger families, no question about it. In fact, when immigrants get here, they're almost certainly having they're having more kids than they would have had they stayed in the old country. In other words, ironically, population growth sort of worldwide actually increases through immigration because people, whether they come from Mexico or from Britain or from the Philippines, when they come to the United States, they have more kids than they would have had in the past. But the difference isn't huge. I mean, they do have somewhat more children than the native-born, but, you know, their kids then don't. So, yes, it has some effect on fertility. That's what the demographers call it. But it's not a huge effect.
Thanks, Brian, for that call. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at the economics of immigration with Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. He's making the case that while immigration greatly helped our economy grow in the past, we've outgrown the need for mass, low-skilled immigration. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Mark, before we go back to our listeners, you mentioned twice before the social costs of immigration. And just outline those for us again, and then there's a bunch of counter-arguments to that argument.
Well, in a modern society like ours, people with low skills end up being net users of government services. In other words, they consume more in taxpayer-funded services than they pay in taxes. It's not a moral fault. It has nothing to do with immigrants, even. It's just the way a modern sort of redistributionist tax system works, whether it's here or anywhere else. And those services, a variety of things, like government-funded, healthcare-type services, public schooling is a big one. And what you end up with is we now have a welfare system, especially since welfare reform, which is designed to support working families with kids. It's become tighter than it was before welfare reform. But the point is, you have to work, and if you have children, you would get extra benefits. And so that's what our system is designed to do. Well, immigrants represent the working poor with kids. And the amount of services that they consume is far beyond anything they're ever going to be able to pay when you add all taxes together. Just at the federal level, it's hard to actually calculate this because there's so many different services and so many different taxes. But just at the federal level, we calculated, this is a number of years ago, that illegal immigrants, this is illegals on behalf of their kids mostly, were a net drain of about $11 billion. And that's not counting public schooling or the rest of it, just federal services and federal taxes. If they got legalized, that cost would balloon to something like $30
billion. Because you're eligible for a lot more.
Because you're eligible for more, exactly. And so the point here, the key point is this is not some kind of moral critique. Obviously, any large group of people has good and bad in it. But the fact is that it doesn't matter that immigrants are hardworking, industrious, generally speaking they are. You can have two or three jobs, though, and if you're a sixth grade dropout from Honduras, you're still going to qualify for government services because you're earning so little. You're earning so little because your educational level is so low. There's no way around that. There's no magic solution to it. And even Milton Friedman once said, you just can't have open immigration and a welfare state. Now, the solution of some people on the right, some of the high immigration people, the Chamber of Commerce and others, is they agree. I mean, it's logically inescapable, but they say, well, the solution is abolish the welfare state.
Right, I've seen that.
Well,
argument.
My answer is, call me when you do that, and then we'll talk. But until then, it's just there's no way you can sustain this.
Okay, so a couple months ago, Mark, I talked to Angela Kelly. She's a pro-immigrant activist. She's with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And a couple things that she said that came up. She said, kids do cost money, but undocumented people like everyone else pay taxes. The Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy looked at Alabama and found that undocumented people in 2010 paid $130 million in taxes. Property taxes, sales taxes. She said a lot of people work with false Social Security numbers and they pay income tax. So she's saying, look, even illegal immigrants pay taxes, never mind legal immigrants. And then she went on to say that illegal immigrants are not eligible for benefits, except for K through 12 education and emergency medical care, which everyone gets. You show up in an emergency room, you get treated. So there's another side to this social cost. There are some people who say, no, it's not as big as you say it is.
Well, I mean, Angie is right. But what she's missing is that immigrant, you have the unit that's relevant is the immigrant family. And because the U.S.-born kids of even of illegal immigrants are U.S. citizens, according to our current practices. And as U.S. citizens, they're eligible for any variety of government services, just like anybody else is. But and so yes, the illegal immigrant parent isn't the one getting the benefit on his behalf, but it's not the four-year-old who's taking the food stamps card to the grocery store and spending it. It's the family as a unit, and families, even those headed by illegal immigrants, create very significant costs on taxpayers. If the illegal immigrant wasn't here, the family wouldn't be here. So illegal immigration does, in fact, create cost, even though illegal immigrants do obviously pay a lot of taxes. They pay sales taxes when you buy a stick of gum. In their rent, even if they're renting, they're paying property taxes because the property tax is kind of figured into the rent. Sure, they're paying taxes, but they are using their families are using significant levels of government benefits, very expensive costs. I mean, we looked, for instance, at a variety of stats here, but just one is Mexican-headed families, families headed by a Mexican immigrant, some legal, some illegal, a lot of them illegal. More than 50% of them were using at least one major federal welfare program. Again, often on behalf of their kids, but it's the family that's benefiting from it. And those costs can't just be wished away or explained away.
Well, we could do a whole hour just on that, Mark, but I'll leave it at that for now because I want to get some more of our listeners involved. And Amy is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Amy. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a comment about what I see in towns like and cities that are like Manchester and Lewiston, Maine. I see a lot of immigrants opening small stores and then other immigrants in the community shopping at those stores. And I see local economies emerging, and I really value local economy and immigrants' contribution to that. And additionally, I think that the comments so far have been talking about the economics based solely on self-interest. And I do think that people in New Hampshire and across the United States make economic decisions based on other values outside of just their own self-interest.
So based on their own self-interest and other values, real quick, Amy, such as?
Such as helping to support the most vulnerable citizens in our global population. Many immigrants and refugees come from parts of the world where the United States has been directly involved in conflict. For example, Manchester, New Hampshire has settled many Iraqis who supported us during that war. And so there are reasons why certain communities are coming into the United States.
All right. Amy, thanks a lot for that call. And we will talk about your thoughts after a short break. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Eric Valliere, the Executive Director of the Nashua Symphony Association. I personally think of NHPR as a source of information, and so for me, underwriting on NPR is analogous to word of mouth. I think when people hear about our concerts through NPR, it's not the same as hearing an ad on another radio station. It feels like you're being informed that something's happening, and I think you listen differently when you listen to NHPR.
To learn more about underwriting, visit the support page on nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Wilson Employment Network, successfully impacting their clients' productivity by recruiting qualified talent for New Hampshire employers for over 12 years online at wilsonemployment.com and Systems and Communication Sciences Incorporated of New Ipswich. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we continue our look at immigration and the economy with Richard Herman, who says immigration is a source of innovation and global competitiveness for our country. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're looking at this topic of immigration and the economy with Mark Krikorian, who's long called for stricter limits on immigration, saying it's a net economic drain for our nation. Let's hear from you. What do you make of this argument? Do you agree or disagree? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is welcome, exchange at nhpr.org. And Mark, just before the break, we took a call from Amy from Manchester, who said that she saw immigrants fueling Manchester's economy with local shops and local restaurants emerging. That whole small business incubator idea that makes America's economy so lively.
Well, I mean, this is one of the kind of urban myths about immigration, is that immigration, you know, is sort of a vitamin B shot of entrepreneurialism into our economy. And it's just not true. I mean, immigrants averaged overall are about as likely to open businesses as the native-born are. I mean, the percentage is not really, it's about the same.
Is it different just that we groups. Notice it more, or is that why?
Well,
or?
I mean, because if you haven't had a Somali restaurant in your town and then one opens, you notice it. You know, sure, there's always going to be businesses but that immigrants open. And then different groups, of course, are more, I mean, Koreans and Middle Eastern immigrants, for instance, are much more likely to be opening businesses. But immigrants from Latin America, who make up the bulk of our new immigration, are much, much, much less likely to be entrepreneurial. So, you know, that's just, it's just, not, I mean, this is one of these kind of warm, fuzzy stories that just doesn't turn out to be true. But the caller did make another point that I think is important. She was saying that, you know, we have to make decisions based on something more than just self-interest.
A value system.
Yeah, right. And that was the point being that we should use immigration as a way of helping the poor overseas. Two points there. One, it's unbelievably inefficient. It's much more efficient to help people where they live. The dollar you spend can do a lot more good than the dollar we're going to spend from taxpayer money of supporting immigrants who are here, number one. Number two, we don't take immigrants from the poorest countries in the world. Mexico, the largest source of immigration to the United States, is an upper-middle-income country by world standards. I mean, immigrants, if you want to have if you want to focus immigration as a way of uplifting the poor, which, like I said, is unbelievably inefficient, you need to look to Congo and Mali Laos, that kind of those places. That's real poverty. Mexico has pockets of real poverty, but it is actually, you know, it's one of those up and coming countries that, in 20 years, we may be looking at as no longer really a developing country.
Gosh, I'm wondering about that, though, Mark. I mean, how up and coming can they be when so many thousands come over here for a better life?
Well, because that's a good point. Immigration often takes on its own momentum. I'll give you Korea for an example, South Korea. South Korea is now a developed country. It's basically at levels of, you know, European levels of development.
Sure, very impressive.
And yet immigration has not stopped, even slowed down. If anything, it's a little higher. I mean, because it's almost like whichever one of Newton's law it was, you know, a body in motion will continue in motion until something stops it. Immigration takes on its own momentum and becomes kind of an expectation of people, even if the, you know, birth rates have gone down and economic conditions have improved. In the long run, sure, it'll taper off. But the long run could be a very long time. It's not something that just switches off in a matter of a couple of years.
Again, our number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange on nhpr.org. And Kyle is up from Laconia. Kyle, go ahead. You're on the air with Mark Krikorian. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for your guest. I was wondering if he's taking into consideration the fact that a lot of immigrants are highly skilled, like doctors, engineers, scientists. You know, if you go to the hospital, you see a lot of the doctors are going to be immigrants. Don't they kind of offset the cost of lower skilled immigrants?
Thanks for the call, Kyle. So don't high-skilled workers, doctors and engineers, offset some of the costs that you outlined for lower-skilled workers? Thanks for that point, Kyle. I got a couple emails on that point, too. Go ahead, Mark.
That's actually a great point, and I understand your caller tomorrow is going to be probably talking mainly about higher-skilled immigrants. And the fact is that immigrants, when you look at them all together, they're about the same percentage of them have college degrees as native-born do. So there's a significant percentage that are college-educated, but the bulk of immigration is less skilled immigrants. I mean, something like half of immigration or more is people with no more than a high school degree, most of them, you know, high school dropouts. And that, and so it doesn't really necessarily, it doesn't balance out. And you got to remember that higher skilled immigrants, though obviously they don't create the same, you know, welfare costs or what have you, and they do pay a lot more in taxes, no question about that, but they often have similar effects in holding down wage growth among the native-born as low-skilled workers. Do you see this very much in the tech industry, where there's a visa called the H-1B visa? It's something some of your listeners may be familiar with.
Very popular. We talked about it on Monday on The Exchange. Right.
Right. Tech companies use it especially to import Indian tech workers. And, you know, generally speaking, those people are certainly, you know, they have jobs. They're not on welfare, but they're not particularly, they're not special. They're not all that high skilled. And they are a tool that employers use to hold down wages for American workers. So there's no question there's more to immigration than just the low-skilled workers, in landscaping, what have you. Nonetheless, that is the bulk of what we're talking about in today's immigration policy. If we wanted to have one that focused just on skills, you could argue for that. I think there's reasons that might be a problem, but that's nothing like what we have now and would require a complete reversal of what our current immigration policy is all about.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, Kyle, because I got a couple emails, too, on this idea of higher skilled workers. Here's an email from Dan in Rye Beach. He says, according to Business News, 60% of high-tech company employees in Silicon Valley are foreign-born. I visited Google last summer. It seemed closer to 90%. Dan says, what about these highly skilled and highly paid employees? Will you force these companies offshore? What do you think? If you start telling the Googles of the world you can't hire immigrants, they all need to go back, Google may say, okay, see you later. We're going to go to China.
Well, first of all, we're not talking about throwing people out who are already legal immigrants.
You're talking about stemming the flow.
Prospectively, future immigration. What will the policy be? Number one. Number two, if the costs really are lower by moving abroad, companies would be doing that anyway, and they always have, and they always will, whether they're computer companies or shoe companies or anything else. I mean, this is an argument basically for saying that the textile industry should be saved by importing lots of people from, you know, from Africa or the Indonesia so that they can work here instead of moving the plants abroad. It's not, I mean, it doesn't make sense. The fact is, it's okay if businesses offshore a certain amount of their work. It happens all the time. Trade is good. If Google or Microsoft are thinking about moving abroad, they often are going to do that anyway because the cost savings would be significant, completely apart from any immigration issues. If they're staying here, there's a reason they're staying here. And it's not just that we're importing workers. Actually, in Silicon Valley, the numbers I've seen are more like about a quarter of the workforce is immigrants, and about a quarter of the new businesses are started by immigrants, which is not surprising. But the idea that we don't have the domestic know-how or capacity to fund a tech industry, to supply a tech industry, is absurd because the tech industry was, in fact, developed here. Hewlett and Packard, in their garage in Silicon Valley in California, weren't immigrants and didn't have immigrants. What this does by having kind of an unending flow is create jobs that Americans won't do, create the expectation for American young people that going into the tech business really is kind of a dead end, because when you turn 35, they're going to fire you and hire an Indian that you're going to have to train anyway, so go and go to get an MBA or a law degree instead. That's not a healthy development for our society.
Wow. Do you really see a lot of businesses doing that? Because I've seen or heard about businesses hiring 45 and up these days because they've got the skills and the maturity and the know-how. So I haven't heard about 35-year-olds being laid off and replaced by a well-educated Indian.
In the tech industry, source on this is the computer science professor Norm Matloff at UC Davis, who's kind of the guru of this issue of tech immigration. And his point is that, 35 is old for many tech companies, and they would really rather have younger people that they basically own than somebody who's, say, 40, an American worker, or even an immigrant worker, who, you know, wants to get home by 6 o'clock to have dinner with his kids. They want a 27-year-old that they own who's going to sleep on the floor in his office. Immigration is one of the tools they use to sort of shape the labor force the way they want it.
Wow, that's pretty cynical view, isn't it, Mark?
Well, I mean, no, because, and I'm not even faulting businesses for doing that. They're operating based on, you know, their goals. The question is, what are the rules that Congress sets for businesses within which they need to operate? And by allowing this constant supply of tech workers from abroad, we are enabling business to meet their goals of maximizing profits in a way that, frankly, doesn't serve the interests of American workers. So businesses aren't doing anything wrong. I mean, some of them are crooked, but that's the case anywhere. Generally speaking, the businesses are just working within the rules that Congress has created. The question is, are those rules in the national interest or not?
Let's take another call. This is Ken in Hanover. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. Go ahead, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning to both of you. I just wanted to kind of congratulate Mr. Krikorsky in there for being sort of a very historical common thread in the debate about immigration, and I mean that somewhat sarcastically, unfortunately, sort of in the best tradition of the know-nothings. You know, the argument against immigration has been going on since day one in this country. You know, there are quotes back in the days of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, you know, being worried about the Hessians invading the U.S. and the language that they're bringing and so forth to the new country. I guess my question really is, in the historical context of all of this, there's always been the nativist sort of view that immigration is bad, and it's always been a particular, you know, a particular ethnic group or religion or race. And it's frankly just wrong.
It's the same old stuff you're saying.
It's the very same old stuff. You're always, you know, you make it up one rung on the ladder, and then you kick the, you know, the next immigrant group that's trying to climb up. And I think if you do look at U.S. history throughout our republic, this same tired argument goes on and on and on. And it's simply immigration is larger than a you know, a political perspective or sort of a narrow vision of what should or should not be. It's the forces are bigger, and it's everything from world politics to economics to just about everything in the human condition.
Okay. And Ken, in the interest of time, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much. What do you think, Mark?
Well, first of all, the Hessians really were invading the United States. They were mercenaries. But anyway, putting that aside, the basic point is, isn't this just the same old argument we've heard over and over
right.
again?
Right.
The answer is twofold. First, to some degree, yes. Because immigration always creates social strains and social problems, even where it's economically beneficial, as I think it was in, you know, settling the Midwest and that sort of thing, it still always created very significant social problems. We dealt with them. We came out better for them. But we can't, you know, we look through rose-colored glasses at the past, and the thing is, you know, things weren't quite as didn't go quite as smoothly as everybody seems to like to think, number one. Number two, though, we are in a very different kind of circumstance. And I love the example of the know-nothings, because the know-nothings were not against immigration. They were for leaving the current policy of open immigration in place. They just wanted to stick it to the people who actually did immigrate and keep them from becoming full members of society. And that's actually more analogous to what many of the libertarian open borders people want, is they want to let in lots of people, but make sure they, you know, don't become permanent members of society. They stay as guest workers. They stay separate. What I'm arguing for is that in the current circumstances, in the different world that we live in, we need to let in far fewer immigrants, but make sure that those we do let in are more successfully incorporated into our national life. It's actually the direct opposite of this of the kind of know-nothing perspective from the 1850s.
You know, you mentioned guest workers, and Mark, I have an email here from Fergus in Dover who says, on guest workers, Red Sox slugger David Ortiz is a guest worker from the Dominican Republic. I suppose Mark would say David Ortiz is taking a job away from an American. If we can have guest workers for baseball, why not agriculture? Fergus says low-skill, low-education immigrants are interested in work and opportunity, not necessarily citizenship. What's wrong with making a distinction between offering legal status and ability to work legally in this country and citizenship? And real quick, Mark, what do you think?
Well, I mean, baseball is hardly a good example because we're talking about a handful of millionaires who can hire all the lawyers they want. Large-scale guest worker programs, especially of low-skilled people, because that's inevitably what it's going to turn out into, are harmful for the republic itself. It moves us more toward, you know, a Saudi Arabian model where we import foreigners to do the work and Americans don't, as opposed to a republic of our citizens. We shouldn't be letting in any significant number of people who are going to stay here for a, you know, long time unless we have in mind that they're going to become citizens. You're always going to have tourists, you're always going to have some foreign students, but people who come here to live should be doing so with the intent of becoming citizens, and we should only be letting in people whose goal is to become us, to join the club, if you will.
So no guest workers. That's a bad idea.
The concept of guest workers, especially large-scale, low-skilled guest worker programs, are very harmful. Barbara Jordan's Immigration Commission from the 90s was unequivocal in saying never should we resort to that kind of program.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for giving your time, giving us our time today. We really appreciate it.
Well, happy to do it. Thank you.
All right, take care. That's Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, an independent nonprofit research organization in D.C. He's the author of several books and numerous articles, including The New Case Against Immigration. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, and our series on New Hampshire's immigration story is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. And this conversation on immigration and the economy continues with other perspectives on Thursday and Friday. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Gall. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.